Next week, Chris Thomas will deliver his first budget, so what can we expect? One former Treasury Minister who wasn't afraid to grapple with the economic challenges of the day was Eddie Teer, and he joins me now in the studio. How do you go about making a budget?
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Phil, to explain to you and your listeners in a bit more depth about what happens. Normally, you start off with a blank piece of paper in August, and then my own personal way of approaching it was you got briefings from departments, but you need to validate these briefings. So I had lots of contacts in the industry, and I would give my contact a ring and say, have you time for a cup of coffee? Can I pop around and see you? And I'd spend maybe an hour or so with them, just talk about general issues. How do you see the economy going? What are the pressures on your sector? Are you hiring? Are you firing? What do you see as the potential pinch points going forward? And something else too, which is in effect fairly easy to do, is if you have a word on the removal people, how many wagons are leaving the island compared with how many are coming in? That gives you a feel on the movements of population.
And you do have Treasury has a statistical team that check all these things, but as ever, if you've spent any time in dealing with money, it's always good to do a sense check on these things as well, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's not that I don't disprove them, but there's two issues here, Phil. The first is that the information they get is somewhat out of date by the time it gets it, or by the time it gets to me anyway. And the other side of the coin is I can get it straight from the horse's mouth. So it isn't filtered before it actually hits my desk. And I can feel more confident if I'm challenged about what I'm doing. But after I've done that, I then have a look at our finances. By that time, I'll have the accounts for draft accounts for the previous year in my hands. What's happened? What the tax receipts are likely? So I'll have a word on the assessor of income tax, get an assessment, if you pardon the pun, from her. And then we just actually push and go. So we'll...
And at the very start there, you referred to a blank piece of paper, but we often hear about this back to basics type budgets where we go for a kind of a fresh start and nothing is on the table. It's all about what you actually need, a proper review, unlike the, well, this is what we had last year, so we could do with a bit more.
There's two issues. The first is the build on what you've had before, as you quite rightly pointed out. And so my own policy was to disabuse people of that opinion. You had to justify everything you got.
And you were good at disabusing people.
Well,
their opinions.
There's two words in the English language, Phil. One is yes and the other's no. And you've got to use no from time to time, not only with departments, but with the general public as well. And I think you need to be fair. And what I would say to them is, look, if you want to do that, tell me what I can cut to pay for it. Simple as that. It's just like managing your own finances. You can't have everything you want. There's no magic money tree. And there's external factors as well. For example, movements in interest rates cost us about, or might benefit us, by about £10 million for every 1% movement. So if interest rates go down, bang, we got a problem. Interest rates gone up now, and I would suspect that's why there's been an increase in personal taxation receipts over the last year or so.
And the going then back to the process, I think we'd got as far as August with the blank sheet of paper.
Yep.
All the departments, presumably, their role, and you've been in departments before, so you know roughly how this works. Each department has had a budget. They have to look at what the pressures were on that budget. They have to look at the responsibilities that they have, whether there are new responsibilities that have been given to them during the year, and then work out what their priorities are, and then create a budget based on that, which they then come to talk to Treasury about.
Yeah, the department and the department members come into Treasury, and it's.
And I should say this was when you and I were in the corridors of power. Things might have changed now.
Well, it's been 10 years, and some would say I'm well past my sell-by date and I'm on my use-by date. So if you have a look at it, we debate with the departments, and then we've got to try and balance the demands of one department against the needs and demands of the other. So then we'll work up all the figures. We think how much we'd be able to spend, so then we'd be able to parcel that out to the departments. So then we'll do a draft budget. It's normally taken, the first cut, if I remember rightly, is taken to the Council of Ministers in November during my time. And then there'll be further discussion in the Council of Ministers. And then by December, it's virtually set in concrete.
And the work, certainly in the later years of our last administration together, there were some quite thorny issues that would be presented at that November budget. So it was very much a case of this is the gap in the finances. These are some of the solutions to fill that gap. And most of them were quite painful solutions, it's fair to say. But they were difficult choices that needed to be taken.
Well, they were difficult choices, Phil. But I think as long as we explained to the public and were, to use a much maligned phrase, open and transparent with them, they might not agree with what we're doing, but they would understand why. And that's the important thing. Because I found myself that when I got my collar felt by a constituent or a member of the public, why have you done this, Eddie? Why have you done that? I'd say, well, actually, it's because of this, this, and this. And they say, oh, all right, okay. I don't agree with you, but I understand why.
Yes, and again, that's an important part of the role of a politician is to have those conversations, and they are often difficult conversations to have, aren't they?
Well, they're not comfortable conversations, very much so. But as I said before, you have to say no from time to time. So we got the budget agreed in December by the Council of Ministers, and then it has to be worked up into a final budget document with the Treasury Minister's foreword in there. Stating the policy and why we're doing it. And then in my days, it was made available to Tynwald members 7 days before the budget meeting. I know it's longer now. I think it's 14 days before the actual budget sitting. And it was, the briefing was given to the Tynwald members on a confidential basis. It wasn't to be disseminated to anybody outside Tynwald. And then on the actual day of the debate, it was always a bit of a nervous time, especially with the Treasury Minister. So the Treasury Minister would move the Treasury order paper or the budget order paper, and the normal form of events would be the Chief Minister would second it and reserve the remarks, which would enable him to come in later on in the debate. Now, when I first started as the Treasury Minister, I had my heads of department in, and anything that came up in the debate which they thought I might not have at my fingertips, they would send me a note. Now, as time went by and technology improved, they just listened to the Tynwald debate from their office, and they'd send me a WhatsApp message, and I would just, the question is so-and-so, the answer is so-and-so.
And of course, despite being pretty much on top of pretty much everything in the department, you can't, even with a kind of encyclopedic memory, you can't remember absolutely everything that's going on in the department. You can't know every single fact. You can't have analysed every single piece of data. So you do rely on officers to help you out, don't you?
Well, you do, and you're there as the head of the department, but you're head of a team. So we're all working together as a team, and we can then actually present the budget and deal with any issues there and then. you do have the fallback position by saying, well, I'll come back to the house later. And then you just pass the question, and then you come back at a subsequent sitting and say, that's the question, that's the answer. So you need to be comfortable and on the front foot. But the funny thing is, the harder you work is, the luckier you get.
Yes, that's certainly the case. Do you think most people understand the budget? I mean, most people, I guess, are just looking to see, are they going to have to pay any more tax this year? And are there some nice little presents about to be dropped in their particular area of work or where they live or whatever?
I think that the average person looks at what affects them. So if I could use the analogy, a jigsaw, they look at one piece of the jigsaw, but they don't see how the jigsaw fits together as an overall picture. Now, it's up to Treasury and the Council of Ministers to actually fit it into a picture that actually works for the Isle of Man and the people of the Isle of Man in general. Now, you're not going to please everybody. That would be nirvana, and that's never going to happen. But what you can do is you can take steps to improve the standard of living and protect the interests of the Isle of Man as a whole. Because unless the Isle of Man as a whole prospers, then unfortunately there's not going to be the money there to enable the services to be supported.
So we've heard the timetable for producing a budget. If you were still in the House of Keys and you'd been a member of the back benches, and 4 weeks before the budget the Chief Minister rang you up and said, do you know what, I'm sacking the Treasury Minister in the morning, do you fancy a job? Well, first of all, what would you have said? And secondly, what chance do you have to influence the budget by that stage?
The first reaction, I'd get me bicycle clips, because that would be a most chastening experience. And what opportunity have you got to try and influence? Zero. You can just basically add a few frills around the outside, but the actual core, well, you can do nothing about. You're stuck with it. Now,
so in essence then, if you were in Chris Thomas's position, I mean, Chris has said that he has been able to influence the budget in a very tiny way, but that was one particular issue which has been trailed very publicly. This is the issue about personal allowances increasing. He's managed to do that, but effectively, I suppose what you're saying is, most of the budget that he'll be delivering will be Alex Allenson's budget.
I can't see how it will be any other way. Now, Chris is, in my opinion, very able. There's no doubt about that. He's highly intelligent, but I don't envy him the position he's in now, because he's going to get blamed for any perceived failings in the budget, but he's had very little input into its preparation. So it's the worst of two evils, really.
I suppose, as Treasury Minister, though, you can point to the obvious point to what you've just said. Well, look, I had 24 hours to influence the budget. I haven't been able to rewrite the budget. And if the electorate spare me, and if the new Chief Minister decides to reappoint me, then maybe next year you'll be able to see what a Chris Thomas budget would look like.
Yeah, I think it puts them in a good position if he wants to be the Treasury Minister next time round. As I say, if he wants to stand and if he is successful in the next election. But he will be taking on a big commitment because there's a major deficit in the Isle of Man's finances. We're spending more per head of the population than other jurisdictions, which I'll go into in more detail later if you want. But it's not a pleasant position to be in at this time.
Well, perhaps the obvious place to look at then is the state of the reserves. We've heard a lot of mention from various people about reserves. It's quite hard to get your head round if you aren't an accountant or you haven't worked in finance areas in government. It is quite hard to understand, but effectively, the overall figure of on the reserves seems to be slightly higher than maybe it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, but that's with investment reserves, and with the stock market at all-time highs, a rising tide lifts every boat. So these reserves have gone up fine through stock market appreciation, but the market can go down as well. I'm old enough to have seen major falls, some cases 30-40% in the stock market within a relatively short period of time. So we can't rely on that. Now, the position has been masked to a certain extent over the last 5 years or so by the borrowing or the raising of a bond for £400 million. So that's given them the liquidity. But I don't remember anybody who's saying or has said that that £400 million has been spent, but it's gone as far as I can see. And I'm definitely not comfortable with the overall position, because over the life of this administration, which has been pointed out by the Economic Policy Review Committee in their recent report, they will have spent £500 million more than they've had coming in. And that's after a profit of £64 million through the Max Electricity Authority, as it was then, gas hedging, which was put in place when I was the chairman.
So that's £500 million has been spent, effectively a £500 million loss, for, if you were talking in basic profit and loss terms, and I know you can't really with government, but that's a lot of money, isn't it?
It's a lot of money, and it has to stop. It just can't go on indefinitely. Now,
well, it particularly has to stop because we've only got, 1.8 billion now in reserves, something like that. Even my basic maths could understand that with increased budgets, there's only so much that you can take out of those reserves before they're not there anymore.
Well, the other thing is, too, that these reserves in the main aren't general reserves. They're set against specific liabilities. For example, National Health Fund. You can't spend any more than that. But what I have noticed is that in my day, I think it was 16% of National Health Insurance contributions went to health. Now it's 24%. So they're actually using the funds more aggressively, in my opinion. There's a separate fund which is set to support the Olive Mann government note issue. You can't use that for anything else. It's boxed for that under the terms of the government note issue. And if we attempted to interfere with that, then people wouldn't accept Olive Mann government banknotes.
And effectively, government note issue means the coins and banknotes that exist on the
island.
That's
right, yeah. Everything which we have, which carries the king's face now or the queen's face it used to be.
Yes, so it's all pointing to a very difficult picture. Regardless of the change in Treasury Minister, what would you have expected to be happening in terms of this year's budget? Bearing in mind, of course, it's an election year, and most MHKs, I from what I'm hearing, would quite like to be an MHK again after the 2026 election.
Well, I can't see them taking any sweeties from the babies, that's for sure. It would be a steady as you go. I think we'd probably both agree if you're going to do anything dramatic, you do it in the first year of an administration rather than the last year. And I can quite understand that, because you're thinking of your future. People believe that politicians have a super job, super pay, but you're only in a five-year contract after all. And at the end of that, if you don't pass the beauty parade, you're out. End of story.
Absolutely. But hopefully places like Manx Radio will still exist in the future, and ex-MHKs might have half a chance. But yes, I mean, but it is a serious point. As an ex-MHK, there are quite a lot of roles, certainly any role in public life, particularly in terms of working for the government in any senior capacity, becomes quite a challenge, because the new MHKs will say, well, you've lost your seat, and actually we don't want to risk any public fallout by appointing you, as even though you might be quite capable of doing a job. So you've got to bear that in mind, I suppose, as an MHK.
Well, if I could just digress for a brief moment, Phil, the thing that's concerned me is the lack of corporate knowledge.
Mm.
And once a senior member, especially of the House of Keys, leaves for whatever reason, everything that they've learnt about government, their connections in industry, in the UK, in politicians in the UK, is gone. So I did leave a note in 2016 when I left to my successor saying, if you want to pick my brains, you're very welcome. Nothing happened.
Hmm.
And I know Alan Bell, whom I had a lot of time for, he had tremendous contacts down in London, both the House of Lords, House of Commons, business contacts down there. And when the pair of us were away lobbying, it was surprising how well known he was.
Hmm.
People would stop and say, hello, Alan, have you got time for a cup of tea, coffee, whatever? And I would have hoped that his successor would say, could you come down to London with me on an occasion or two and introduce me to your contacts?
Hmm.
And that would get the new chief minister, treasury minister, whatever, up to speed much quicker than having to work up your contacts yourself.
And it's not just that, I suppose. It's also understanding how the system works, because you do need to have some. I mean, but I would imagine anyway, as a brand new, wet behind the ears MHK coming in to try and consider your first budget in February, it won't be that easy to get your head round at all.
No, it isn't. As I said before, I do deeply sympathise with Chris Thomas. I don't want to increase his anxiety level, but it's not going to be an easy time for him. Surely he will handle it responsibly, and he's not. He doesn't bear any liability or responsibility what's gone on before.
Mm.
And they should have pulled back sooner on this increased expenditure. An illustration is us, older section of the community, I'm not putting you in that category, but older section of the community.
I'm getting closer now.
We got 3 years ago, I think it was £300 cost of living payment in our pensions. Now, I did say to Alex Allison, whom I bumped into afterwards, why didn't you means test it? It seemed crackers to me. Why did you give it to somebody like me? Because I'm in a fortunate position. And he said, oh, no, we couldn't means test it. Now, if you couldn't have means tested that, how can you means test other benefits?
Mm.
It just didn't stack up to me.
Yeah. Let's look then at the headline that's likely to be in this budget, and it's one of those rare occasions where the Chief Minister, probably even more than the Treasury Minister, have trailed this particular issue, and that is personal allowances. Obviously, the personal allowances is going, well, according to the media releases, we'll have to wait and see what's in the budget, but according to the media releases, the personal allowances are going to be increased, and in some way that compensates the lowest paid in society who were going to benefit from a 9% increase in the minimum wage to achieve the living wage. How does all that work?
Well, it... in effect, it reduces the income of a person which will be liable to income tax. And I think that's a good thing. And also, too, it'll help the economy, because it should leave more money in the hands of the public to spend in the local economy. Now, in the Isle of Man, for the benefit of your listeners, it's currently £14,500. In Jersey, it's £20,000. Jersey has a surplus of just under, I think it's £48-49 million in its budgets. We have a deficit of nearly £100 million. So there just needs to be a bit more scrutiny on what we're spending.
So how have they done that?
Well, I would love to know, because I think they got a tighter control over their expenditure. I'm a director of a Jersey company, and I go down to Jersey on a quarterly basis, and it doesn't look as if they're skimping on anything. They're doing well. Now, in last year's budget, the Isle of Man on a per head basis allocated just over 17,000 per head of population, public spending. In the Isle of Man, it's 11,500. So in Jersey, it's 11,500. Why? And Jersey spend less on health than us. Why? And similar comparators with the UK. We're also out of line.
I mean, the difference, I suppose, in the UK at least, is that local authorities, of course, pay for some of the services that are delivered at a national level here. And presumably, I mean, I don't know, is there some sort of health insurance in Jersey?
You have to pay for, if you're able, you pay for or make a contribution towards an appointment with a doctor. Mm. Fine. But at least you do get an appointment quickly.
Yes, and presumably some eager listener, possibly an eager Tynwald listener, may be making a note of this and saying, well, OK, how is it then that Jersey is able to spend so much less per head of population and still have good services? Perhaps even there's a programme in it. Maybe I need to go on a fact-finding mission to Jersey, if only Manx Radio's budget would run to that far. but it's certainly quite a stark difference, isn't it? I mean, we're talking, 40% more, maybe even more than that?
More than 40%. It really illustrates that we should stand back and look at what we're doing. I'm not saying that we're apples and apples here, as you pointed out with the UK. In some cases, apples and pears. But we should be having a look, and we should be open with the public and saying, look, we can't afford to do everything we're doing. What is essential to do as opposed to what is nice to do? And we'll have to actually deal with it. Because we can't, as I said before, carry on as we are. The other little issue I would be looking at is immigration. Now, I agree that we should be increasing the working age population, but should we be allowing older people to come to the island who, whilst they might be in good health at the moment, wind the clock on 4 or 5 years, they might be calling on our health services? So we need to be more selective in allowing people into the island. Now, you recall that there's legislation on the statutes books.
Before our time as well, isn't it?
Even before our time, the Residency Act. Mm. Now, it just needs an appointed mayor.
So, I mean, that's a good quarter of a century old, that legislation.
Well, all you have to do is to decide how you're going to implement it, and bring in an appointed day order. Job done. Mm. So it's fairly simple.
So why haven't people done that then?
I just don't know. It's too easy to say, well, I don't want to change the status quo. Mm. But if we're going to get out of this hole, we need to do it.
It's funny, we had on the programme last week the former president of the Manx National Farmers Union, Ian Parsons, talking about the meat plant of all things and saying, you know, we've kind of tinkered around at the edges on this for pretty much since 2008, when we lost the red meat derogation, but also lost a big chunk of VAT money from the revenue sharing arrangement. And it's time to do something radical, was Ian's view. But actually, we're not good at doing radical in the Isle of Man, are we?
We're not. Now, to support Ian, I would say 100% agree with him. And to put a bit more meat on the bones, we had to leave the derogation because at the time we were in the European Union, common market. Mm. We're not now. So why don't we just bring it back in?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, we're not here to debate the red meat derogations, but the World Trade Organization might have something to say about that as well. And we are still subject to the strictures of the World Trade Organization. I suppose the point that he was making is maybe we need to stop just playing around at things, despite the pain that has been suffered when various things have, the squeeze was put on, certainly in our last 5 years as ministers, the squeeze was put on various aspects of public finances, and pain was felt. It didn't solve the problem because we're pretty much still in, with the same level of deficit now as we were even before we left office.
If you don't ask, then you don't get. Now, my view is we should at least have the courage to ask. By being timid isn't going to solve anything at all. But if you have a look at the first couple of years of accounts during the Quayle administration, the deficits were starting to come down. So I think Alan Bell can hold his hand up for that. Because that was as part of his administration. And then once the effects of what he'd done wore out, as it were, then the deficit started to rocket.
Yeah.
And to labour the point I've been trying to make, that needs to be dealt with.
And dealing with that doesn't necessarily mean squeezing public finances and causing services to be cut. It could mean a kind of a radical rethink about how all of this is done.
Well, how services are delivered. Now, I apologise for getting rather technical, but your listeners probably haven't heard of the concept span of control. Now, that's the number of layers of management between the boss and the cleaner, as it were, metaphorically speaking. Now, in my former life, we used to have a look at how many layers are there, and if it got to eight, it was a bit punchy. So I remember we took out a complete layer when I was in health. Now, when that happened, did anybody complain about the standard of service going down? Now, roll on, and a large part of that work has been undone, I feel, maybe unduly critical, but has the standard of service to the public improved since then? I would say not, from the feedback that I get.
And AI, you know, this is possibly seen by some cynics as grasping at nettles, but is AI, artificial intelligence, likely to resolve some of this? Because presumably it can help decision makers, so you can avoid some of the layers of bureaucracy by relying on AI.
You can actually deal with some of the more mundane tasks by AI, like, for example, benefits calculations. Talking about benefits, the state public sector pay, or the public sector pay body, they still send out every month pay slips. They even send them out to pensioners. Now, they don't change month on month. I get a pension from my former employment with the bank, and I never get an advice. The only thing I get is at the end of the tax year, a T14 saying how much I've had over the year. And also, too, when there's a change, if there's any change, I get told then, but otherwise not. So there are things, simple things, that can be done, fairly straightforward. But as I said before, it's easier just to carry on as you are.
And that often is the problem across government, whether we're talking about budgets or whether we're talking about any area of government. It's more difficult to get agreement to what the solution might be than it is to accept that actually we'll just carry on with the problem we've got and maybe throw a bit more money at it.
Well, the first thing is you've got to accept there's a problem. Now, I don't think that on the basis of the figures before you could argue that there wasn't a problem. And then to go back what I said before about opening and transparency, we must explain to the public that there's this problem. We can't carry on as we are. So what we're doing is, in the long-term interests of the sustainability of the island, we have to do this. Sorry, but we're in a corner and we've got to come out fighting. And two, I'm also anxious that the island looks to the next sector to grow the economy. Mm-hmm. Now, I get on a regular basis the Weekend Financial Times, and on occasions there's adverts from Jersey and Guernsey. I don't see any from the Isle of Man. Interestingly enough, the one from Jersey says, come to Jersey, stable taxation. That's a nice dig at us, having put the tax up to 22% and then reduced down to 21%. And it gives out the wrong message to potential investors.
We've kind of been talking primarily about expenditure, but income is the other way in which we can solve part of this problem. It is fair to say that for quite some time now, it's probably getting on, we're well into the second decade, where we've struggled to see the levels of growth that the Isle of Man benefited from prior to the early or to mid-2000s.
There's a need to diversify the economy and also to encourage our new graduates from the island to come back to the island to work as well. Now, I'd done a lot of work with my colleagues in Treasury, working up a scheme to encourage Isle of Man nationals who were graduates from UK universities or further afield who've been supported by the Isle of Man government to come back to work on the island. Now, my scheme was, for what it was worth, to offset any income tax they paid on employment in the Isle of Man against their student loan. So the chances of us recovering the student loan might not have been strong. So from a cash flow point of view, it wouldn't have been very impactful on our finances. But we don't seem to be able to think outside the box and take things forward.
And that is what's needed, isn't it? When all else seems to be failing. And again, I certainly wouldn't want to cause the listener too much undue panic, but we are in pretty difficult financial times at the moment, aren't we?
We are, and as I said, that £400 million has gone. There's talk now of about another ship for the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company. They've just closed the consultation on that at the moment, and that's going to involve further finances as well. But I was disappointed when they bought the steam packet, which I don't think I could have recommended. I think you were the minister when we met.
Yes, yeah, we were both in the room and had those discussions, and it looked to me, and you know, I'm possibly more towards the left of centre than you are, but it looked to me as though a deal could be done where the steam packet would still be an independent company, and we would get pretty much most, if not everything, that we wanted.
Well, I wasn't impressed with the openness of those representatives from the controlling bodies of the steam packet when they came to see us. They didn't appreciate that we'd done our homework, that we knew what we were talking about. And that was about the briefest meeting we ever had, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
They bounced out through the door afterwards.
but as I say, as things developed, it did look as though the deal that could be made would have allowed the steam packet to stay in private hands and us to benefit, the people of the Isle of Man, the Isle of Man government in particular, to get it needed out of the deal without risking taxpayers' money in vessels and ownership of the company.
Well, the biggest issue was, from their point of view, is we need some certainty so that we can invest in a new vessel. But why pay them for a piece of paper that we'd given them earlier? My own personal decision would be, right, we'll take the uncertainty away. We will buy a ship suitable for the Irish Sea, which we'll lease to you on commercial terms, be a bareboat charter. So in other words, it'd be all with their livery on board, Alamann steam packet, but it'd be owned by the Alamann government. Now, there'd be two positive sides to that. The first would be that we had a tangible asset. The second would be, as the newser agreement started to wear down, they would know full well that we had Plan B in place and they couldn't do anything about it. So it put us in a much stronger negotiating position.
Yeah.
And what do? We buy a piece of paper on the basis that it's an arm's length transaction, and then there's questions in the House of Keys and Tynwald.
Mm. Now, and anyone with any political nous must realise that an arm's length company that's owned by the government that is in so much, there's so much public interest in, is never going to be an arm's length company.
Correct, but I also feel that the Treasury Minister should not have answered those questions. Mm. He said, well, look, the resolution of Tynwald was arm's length, and you're asking me to go against that now. So I'm sorry, I can't do that. And just sit down.
And some Treasury ministers in the past would certainly have done that. I remember you well, Eddie. In terms then of, I'm going to ask you to do your Mystic Meg thing, whether you can do that or not, I don't know. What do you expect to see in the budget? Are there going to be rabbits pulled out of hats, or are we? The best we can hope for is as steady as she goes.
I can't see any rabbits being pulled out of the hat because there's no bottom in the hat now. They've already said there's going to be a change to the personal allowance, but I'd be very surprised if there's going to be anything beyond that. As you said before, we're into an election year now and it's not the time to do anything drastic. And I do sympathise with them, but it's problems of their own making.
And reserves, I mean, are reserves likely to be continued to be relied on? Are we going to have a deeper dig into reserves, or where would you think that they'll go?
I think in the short term there will be, but you can't rely on them in the long term. Hmm. You've got to sort of grasp the nettle and deal with it. And the next administration are going to have a difficult job and they'll need some steel in their backbone.
Should it be making any difference that there's a Labour government in the UK as opposed to a Conservative government or whatever the government may be? I mean, there's talk possibly of a Reform government, maybe even the Green Party and other. Well, should the political makeup of the UK matter that much when it comes to the Isle of Man?
I don't believe it does. I always thought that the Conservative government would be more amenable to the Isle of Man, but I got on well with the Labour administrations and the Conservative governments as well. It goes back to what I was saying about keeping contacts in London and Westminster going. Now, we went to the various party conferences. I think you went to the Liberal Democratic one, if I remember well.
And Labour and SNP. I've almost got the full set.
They wouldn't have been my natural environments, I'll give you that. But I've been to the Conservative and the Labour ones as well. And I found to meet them when they were just assumed they were surrounded by friends was a much better way of generating a relationship with them, which you can build on in the future. And also too, the biggest opportunity you had was to catch a government minister there. And I would say, hello, I'm Eddie Tier, Treasury Minister of the Isle of Man. I'm down in London quite often. Do you think I could have 20 minutes from your diary next time I'm in London? And they always said yes. Give them a card and then go back to the office and said, I've been talking to XYZ.
Yeah.
He said, it's all right. Get onto them, please, and put them on the next list. And then I go down, bang, gotcha.
I'm going to give you my party conference anecdote as we are drawing towards. We're not quite at the end of the programme yet, but I was at a British-Irish Council meeting with the then Environment Secretary, Ed Davey. He was part of the coalition government, and I forget what we were discussing now, but anyway, a few months later, I was at the Lib Dem party conference, and in a very, very crowded lobby, I was feeling somewhat bewildered, I have to say. And then from the other side of the lobby, Ed Davey spotted me, shouts across, "Hi, Phil, come over here, and we'll have a cup of tea." And of course, Ed Davey, now the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party. But so it does show, you know, these contacts, knowing people, particularly in a system as big as the UK, you know, the Isle of Man, it's different. It's very easy to know your politicians here, but in the UK, when often you can find that you're banging your head against a brick wall, primarily because the brick wall that you're banging it against doesn't really understand the constitutional niceties of how the Isle of Man and the UK interacts. And you know that if you could just get to speak to the minister, you could probably solve the problem. Having those contacts really does help to break down those barriers. And provided the Isle of Man has got something that the UK wants, or, you know, if we've got an offer for them, something that's worth their while, why wouldn't they want to talk to us?
Well, you're quite right there, because I had a super relationship with David Gawke, the number two in the UK Treasury. And at the beginning, it was very formal. At the end, it's, "Hello, Eddie, how you doing? I haven't seen you for a while." And a bit of general chit-chat before we actually started. And I also remember speaking to the Pensions Minister, Ros Altman. She was a class act. I had a great deal of time with her. And she said, the staff said, "You got 20 minutes and that's it." 40 minutes we had. And just sort of talked it through. We got an agreement with her straight away. But it goes back again to developing those personal contacts, which you can't do overnight. And that's why if you had somebody introducing you to the contact, that would certainly help
it helps,
to smooth the path.
It? Yeah.
But the other thing I'd like to mention as well, Phil, is we need to be more proactive. Now, the UK Public Accounts Committee was on our case. Ms. Hodge, she was the chair of the PAC at the time. And I remember I was at a meeting in the Speaker of the House of Commons' private apartment. She was there and she gave me both barrels about the Isle of Man, tax haven and everything else. So I said, "Tell you what, you tell me when you want me to appear in front of your committee and I'll defend it." Never heard another thing.
Yes. Yeah. It's always good to go out on the front foot, as you say.
Yeah.
The budget is a well-kept secret. One of the things that we often hear about is the need for budget reform. Do you think that's ever going to happen?
No, because it'd be too difficult to administer.
Right.
I know some members are seeking a line-by-line vote on the budget, but that would be fine as long as they'd agree to something be taken out. And you can just imagine if you identified something to be taken out, what the reaction would be on other sides of the House. Hmm. So, no, it's much better, really, if that's it. You have a look at the whole picture. Either you agree with the whole picture or you don't. End of story. Now, in my days, I don't think I had more than three or four people vote against the budget. And you probably noticed I didn't labour the point in doing the summing up. If you feel you got 10 members with you, you don't insult them by actually going through every issue point by point. Just pick out the main ones, do 15 minutes summing up, and then thank you very much.
Well, we'll find out. It's fair to say Chris Thomas is not known for brevity, but we will find out on Budget Day whether he is going to be relatively brief or whether he's going to go chasing after every single rabbit that's presented to him.
Well, if I could just be bold enough to give them some advice. Just look at body language in the chamber. And once you see people switch off or look down, then it's time to sit down. I was always told you only get 10 minutes to make a good first impression and then you stop drilling.
That was former Treasury Minister and MHK for Ayr, Eddie Teer. So what do you think? It's easy to talk about tighter control of public finances, but what would you cut? Is government doing enough to support our beleaguered Manx economy? With dwindling reserves, how will we face up to future economic storms? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Myos and Geisha Crom. Thanks for listening.